Welcome to Getting Through It, where we're here to help you get through it. I'm John Bueri, and as always, I'm with myth-busting Dr. Lucy Jones. This podcast is sponsored in part by individuals like you, so consider becoming a sponsor today and visit us at patreon.com to sign up. That's patreon.com and search Dr. Lucy Jones. Now let's get to it. We're here to talk about the craziest things humans have invented to explain the uncertainty of earthquakes. We're going to break it down by looking at some common myths, legends, and misunderstandings that stand in for true understanding. Although these myths may make us feel better, when in fact they are caused by fear, they don't actually help because they're not true. So let's start with the big one. And I'm not talking about the big earthquake. It's actually the idea that little earthquakes release pressure, so a big one is less likely.
Yeah, obviously this would make us feel a lot better when you have a little earthquake. You could think, oh, at least it's relieving the stress. The problem is that the relative number of large to small earthquakes is actually quite constant on any group of earthquakes. So that for every, you know, one magnitude six, you need 10 magnitude fives and 100 magnitude fours and 1,000 magnitude threes. You have 1,000 magnitude threes, we're actually going to be thinking, whoa, where are the bigger earthquakes that need to be part of this distribution? And then because the biggest earthquakes release even more energy. So we have 100 times as many fours as sixes, but the six releases 1,000 times more energy. Those fours can never replace the six. We always have to have those big ones.
So little earthquakes do not relieve pressure to prevent the big one from coming.
Unfortunately, right.
Now, what about time of day? We just had an earthquake in Los Angeles in late July, 2020. And there was a question of, well, this earthquake was just at the same time as the Northridge earthquake of 1994 at about 4:30 in the morning. There must be something about 4:30 in the morning or something in that pre-dawn hour. Can you explain time of day?
Unfortunately, too, whenever we've gotten enough earthquakes, the time of day is random. This is one of those myths that we really want to be true because the earthquakes would be less scary if they happened in the middle of the night where you know where your kids are, you know where your spouse is, you're all at home together. That's safer than, you know, 2 in the afternoon and you don't know where they are. So we want that to be true so badly. We remember the times that it's true and forget the times that it's not. And then you discover that people's definition of early morning goes anywhere from, you know, 2 a.m. to 9 a.m. And now we're talking about close, you know, we're starting to approach a third of the day. So you expect a third of the day anyway. And we forget the Loma Prieta earthquake, the World Series earthquake that was at 5 p.m. or the Imperial Valley earthquake in 1940. That was one of the most damaging earthquakes California ever had, 9:30 at night. The Long Beach earthquake that brought us all of our basic earthquake codes. That was at 6 in the evening. So we've forgotten the ones that don't fit. We remember the ones that do because we so want it to be true.
So it's completely random. There's no indication that time of day has anything to do with when the earthquake will come.
Unfortunately, that's exactly right.
There's also this idea, and I think we know that this is true across the globe, that every culture has an idea of earthquake weather. How does that come to be? I know I've heard people talk about shake and bake, right? When it's hot, we get earthquakes. Or the muggy weather, that feels dank, and so it must be earthquake weather. How come same people, same region, have different definitions of what earthquake weather is, and why do we even have earthquake weather?
Basically, every culture assigns earthquake weather to the weather they had at their most memorable earthquake. Because again, we want a pattern, because if it only happens when it's really hot, then when it's cold, maybe it's going to be okay, right? It's, again, a way of thinking that we're going to be safe. That idea of the hot and the muggy or the dank weather is a perfect one. Because to my mother, who grew up in Los Angeles and was 5 years old when the Long Beach earthquake happened, in March, in the fog, pretty dank weather. To her, whenever we had that really still fog, she'd call it earthquake weather. And then in 1987, after a period without any significant earthquakes for a while in LA, and we had the Whittier Narrows earthquake October 1st, and it was really hot. Because, you know, in LA on, you know, 1st of October, it's often Santa Ana's and really hot. And that became that type of earthquake weather. And I've even seen people really shift it where they talked about it being a Santa Ana for Northridge. which wasn't true, actually. The Santa Ana came in a few days after the Northridge earthquake when we were having a lot of aftershocks. But because it fit that pattern, people were able to think it was true without actually going and testing it. So, I mean, I read stuff. I was reading old Roman letters looking at the eruption of Mount Vesuvius and discovered that even back in the first century, they were talking about earthquake weather. So the idea has legs. Unfortunately, it's not true.
I want to talk about prediction. And we could have a whole, and probably do have a whole episode about, or two, about prediction. But specifically, prediction from animals. A lot of people say, oh, you know, my cat got all excited and the next thing I know there was an earthquake. Or my dog, you know, jumped out of the hallway. And I know that there's two kinds of waves, that actually animals are more sensitive to the first wave, right, the P wave, versus what, right, we usually feel as humans at the S wave. But can animals predict earthquakes? I mean, I think I know the answer.
Yeah, unfortunately, whenever we've had a controlled situation, we are really struggling to find anything. You know, I actually worked in China when I was in graduate school because I spoke Chinese, and it was when China was first opening up, and they were talking about having animals as a program. And so I'm actually one of the few Western scientists to have written a paper on animals' awareness of earthquakes. And when we went through and analyzed, you know, actually graphed out the time at when all of the reports came in, we were able to see that the most common, the only signal in the data was that most of the reports are a big peak would happen on Saturday afternoons. And this is during the Cultural Revolution in China, and Saturday mornings, the communes, the farming communes, would have party meetings where you had to all come in and, you know, swear your allegiance to the Communist Party. And they got told then to go out and find animal anomalies. And every afternoon they'd go out and find the animal anomalies to satisfy the request to do this. So again, with controls, none of this is ever held out. It does appear that animals are more likely to feel the beginning of the earthquake, what's called the P wave, than human beings are. And so you get this thing of, you know, 5 or 10 seconds before the human thinks the earthquake begins, the animal jumps up. And we've actually caught that on surveillance cameras quite a bit. An animal jumping up and looking around, and then the earthquake, you know, appears to begin to the human. And I think one of the things, again, if you want a pattern, if you need that pattern because you feel safer if that happened, if you can say that it'll happen now, you know, you see the animal do it 5 seconds before, well, why not 5 minutes or 5 hours? And what about that stomach ache that they had? So very important part of the constraint is to see whether or not, you know, make sure that however you're looking at the animal information doesn't include the knowledge that an earthquake's just happened, because then the human attributes more significance to the behavior that they might have ignored otherwise.
There are dozens and dozens of myths and legends and stories that try to explain why an earthquake happens. And we could probably spend a lot of time talking about them. We just hit a couple of the big ones here, pun intended. Before we leave here today, why does this happen? Why do people do this? And you said, you know, from the first century, right, the Romans were doing the same thing, trying to create patterns, trying to explain things that they couldn't really understand. Why do we have the need to do this?
Well, because think about it. We evolved to be human in a dangerous place. And we didn't have, you know, the big muscles that our competitors did. And we needed to, what we had was the brain. And if we could make a pattern that could tell us which way the predator was moving or where it was hiding, we could be safe. And that need for a pattern that lets us be safe, I know it was the people who could do that that lived to have the kids. And so it's pretty deeply wired in our DNA. From the earliest human cultures, we see this. We see pagan stories of, you know, Venus cheating on Vulcan and setting off the volcano. Or within the Christian Jewish tradition, you have Noah's Ark and people sinned and therefore God punished them. Or you go to the Eastern traditions and you have a yin-yang imbalance with the feminine yin overcoming the yang earth, if there's too much feminine forces in government. You know, so every one of us has come up with a reason like this, because it's fundamental to find a pattern that lets us find the path to safety. And that the drive for that doesn't need logical reasoning. And it's why we have science and the scientific method and statistics to determine whether or not the earthquakes or any disaster are actually happening more often in any of these situations. And I'm afraid that most of the patterns that we find don't hold up.
Well, let's leave it there for this time, and we'll do it again soon. So until next time, I'm John Buery with Dr. Lucy Jones and you, Getting Through It. Getting Through It is a production of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Visit us online to get past shows and become a supporter at patreon.com. That's patreon.com and search Dr. Lucy Jones. There you can get extras, insights, and access to the entire world of Getting Through It. Our music is performed by Josh Lee, and this closing music is written by our own Dr. Lucy Jones.